KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We'll go to theaters and warehouses, cars, trains, planes, so that if we do get a call of a bomb threat, I know that my dog wouldn't be apprehensive to get on a moving train.
It's reconnecting to place and to our place in it, and finding climate and the site and the world around us as a resource inside our buildings.
The police are only getting the junk and the stuff that's more valuable than the gift cards. They're selling out here at discount prices.
Today on Weekday, we're going to meet a bomb dog, a bomb-sniffing dog. We're also going to talk about how daylight gets into our buildings and makes us happier workers. And we're going to talk about Seattle Public Schools and the levee. We're going to talk about South Africa. We're going to talk about how poetry can help heal. But we're going to start with that gun buyback program. Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn will announce the number of guns collected in the Saturday gun buyback program in about 25 minutes. That's when it's scheduled. On Saturday, the police were still checking the guns' serial numbers and then tossing them into a large panel truck. They were stacked waist high by about 2 p.m. The Seattle gun buyback 20 years ago swept up 1,200 guns in a four-day event. This time, the police gave away $80,000 in gift cards plus IOUs after they ran out, and they ran out pretty quickly. Those people turned away, or those who wanted cash rather than a gift card, could turn to the small scrum of people along 7th Avenue with handwritten signs, notebook paper, Sharpies. Some had printed signs, all offering to pay cash for guns. Watched a guy pull up, roll down his window. He got a few offers. People came running. One buyer went to the back, popped the hatch, and after a quick inspection, the man drove off with cash, and the buyer had an old shotgun and an old pistol. Both had serial numbers. They checked them, so they were headed to the gun buyer's safe. It was odd to watch a woman in the station wagon drive up to the police with a pair of rifles in the back, or see folks walking up to gun sellers with shotguns and paper and plastic bags. One very old man wandered up with perhaps an equally old rifle in a paper bag, and police kind of gathered him up and pointed him towards the line. He was followed by an even older woman, perhaps, who was carrying a pistol, and she held it up to an officer, handle high, pinched between finger and thumb, like some odious and slightly dirty object. Seattle Detective Mark Jamison was the public information officer for the event. He was doing interview after interview, not just with Seattle TV, newspapers, and radio, but also with TV crews from Finland, Japan. Mark Jamison is our guide to the buyback program. We also meet Robert Malvado, Phil, Jim Larson, who were selling their guns, and we chat with a couple of gun buyers, Philip Irvine and Ken. Those who didn't give their last names chose not to.
We had the event. We had people come in off of 7th, would come down. They were either on foot or in their vehicle. They would queue up. Once they got down to this area.
Robert Lovato. And why are you here?
To get rid of an old weapon that's been around the house for about 15 years that I don't use at all.
And is it work?
Yeah, it's operational. It's a black powder 31 caliber CVA muzzle loader. The goal in that type of gun is to shoot it in the cloud of smoke and run away.
An officer would approach them, and they'd say, "Officer, I've got X number of weapons in my car. They're in the trunk. No problem, sir. Just go ahead and pop the trunk. You don't have to do anything."
I have a handgun.
A handgun?
And it's an old, probably 100 years old almost, but it doesn't work.
Oh.
And so I thought, well, rather than just sitting in my drawer, I can't throw it in the garbage can. And so I might as well get rid of it this way and maybe make some money to buy a new pair of running shoes.
The officer would go physically retrieve that gun or guns, take it over to the tent, make sure that it is rendered safe, everything was good, secure it, and then they would receive the appropriate amount of gift cards. Then they're on their way.
My name is Jim Larson. I'm a hunter. I've got several guns. This is one I don't use anymore. I was always looking for a way, really, just to get rid of it because it's not of use to me. And go ahead.
It's hard to get rid of them otherwise.
In a way, I mean, you can take it to a gun shop and they don't want to give you anything for them. And I really don't want to sell it to somebody I really don't know. I mean, you know, like, yeah. you know, through a gun broker or something like that, it's kind of a hassle because you've got to go dealer to dealer. So it's just, this was an easy way to get rid of something I'm not using. And I definitely appreciate the gift certificate.
So the guns that are collected over at that tent, they're brought over here. Officers then are reading off makes and models and serial numbers of the weapons. Those will eventually be checked for stolen. Any weapon that is determined to be stolen, we will make every effort to contact the owner, let them know that we've recovered their weapon, see what they would like done with it.
My name is Philip Urban. We have here a gun show with none of the responsibility, none of the restrictions. The police have brought people here who want to sell guns, and they can't because they've run out of coupons. So you've got a whole bunch of people who want to sell the guns, and the only way they can sell them is to sell them to people here on the street. The police are only getting the junk and the stuff that's more valuable than the gift cards. They're selling out here at discount prices.
My name's Ken, but a gun show is much more controlled. This is very free-for-all. It's very strange, yes. This is a Remington shotgun. It's not in great condition, but it was exactly what they needed to do. They needed to get rid of a gun that they clearly had no use for and been kicking around in somebody's closet. This is going to go sit in my gun safe. It's now... At least it's off the streets of Seattle, I guess, huh?
Yeah. What do you think of the argument that this is supposed to help crime and safety?
Well, I believe that there's a lot of studies that have shown that never really happened. On the other hand, like I was telling you earlier, the guys with the sawed-off shotgun, it's a felony to possess it. Nobody who knows guns wants that gun. You couldn't pay most of them to take that gun. To have amnesty to turn it in... It's ridiculous that you do it every 20 years, but you've got to be able to dispose of this somehow.
Well, so that makes it a good thing in that sense.
Well, another thing is that this is creating a market for stolen guns. This is a market for stolen guns.
Except they say they're going to check to see if they're been used in any criminal activity or anything.
That's fine, but I can go and... I now have an incentive to go out and steal guns, bring them into a gun show like this, get a gift card for it, which I couldn't do at a gun shop. So this is creating a market for stolen guns.
Let's hope that didn't happen.
Well, it's creating an incentive, and certainly there are some people here who are highly motivated. They want to turn their guns in. That's what their incentive is. Others, they want to get some cash for it. There is... You know, some good effects to this, but it's very badly outweighed by the gun show, the unregulated gun show environment that they have here.
These weapons will be taken down to the Newcourt facility in West Seattle, where they'll be destroyed.
Was this a success?
You know, I think it was an overwhelming success. We really had no idea of what the response would be. It's been over 20 years since the city has done anything like this. And I think, you know, just with the recent events and the community support and corporate support, I think a lot of people... decided that, yeah, you know, I do have an old gun in my house that, I don't feel comfortable with, or, you know, there's no need for me to have it. I want to get rid of it properly.
Seattle Detective Mark Jamison was our guide to the Saturday gun buyback program. That was an AR-15 that was being cocked, by the way, in working order, according to the police officer who cocked it. And we heard some opinions from some other folks about what that gun buyback program and the free-for-all outside was doing. You know, the police disagreed with that assessment. We met Robert Movado, Phil, and Jim Larson. They were selling their guns. We talked to a couple of gun buyers, Philip Irvine and Ken. And as I said, Seattle Detective Mark Jamison was our guide to that. Seattle police ran out of gift cards pretty early, $100 for handgun, shotgun, and rifles, $200 for assault weapons. I was looking at those rifles as they were being tossed into the back of this
big panel truck. It was, they were getting pretty high up there. And they had a couple of these pump action shotguns. The Seattle Times says they're called 12-gauge repeater shotguns, known as street sweepers. I did not see the rocket launcher. And that loophole that gave us those folks buying guns in the street, that Seattle Times also quoted Mike McGinn as saying that those needed to be closed because of the fact that some guns could be exchanged on the streets that shouldn't be in circulation. A couple other towns had gun buyback programs, by the way, this week. 79 guns in Miami were recovered following a second gun buyback they had there. And they also had a gun buyback in Trenton, New Jersey, where they got 2,600 guns. That was announced just a few hours ago. And the mayor of Seattle will hold a press conference scheduled for 9:30, where he'll tell us how many guns were bought back and will be destroyed in this gun buyback program. This is Weekday.
Nine 16. We're going to take up the Seattle school levies in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Saturday night at one of the nation's busiest hospital trauma centers. Patients with bullet wounds arrive just minutes apart.
Cold compressions, intubate, see if you have cardiac motion.
How smarter trauma care is saving more gunshot victims. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms & More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, offering consumer education seminars on selecting a mattress, 9:30 Saturday mornings. Information online at howtoshopforamattress.com.
41 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17. We're going to meet a bomb-sniffing dog who works for the Seattle Police Department in about 15 minutes.
Bomb-sniffing dog. I'm looking forward to that. That's coming up later in the show. But first, now on to Seattle school levies. On February 12th, Seattle voters will be asked whether or not to renew two expiring levies to fund Seattle public schools. Maybe you've already received information in the mailbox. Proposition 1 would raise nearly $552 million over 3 years to fund day-to-day expenses, textbooks, transportation, student activities. Proposition 2 would raise $695 million over 6 years to pay for building renovations, earthquake safety, improvements, and security cameras. Two levies combined would cost homeowners an additional $152 per year based on a home that's worth about $400,000. Greg Wong is president of Schools First, a campaign organization that works to help pass Seattle school levies. He's also an attorney at Pacific Law Group in Seattle. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
Chris Jackins is a coordinator for a Seattle Committee to Save Schools. He's the official spokesperson on the No on Prop 2. And he has been working on Seattle school levies and looking at their costs for many years. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
First of all, that the two levies combined would cost homeowners an additional $152. Is that on top of the renewal, or is that the renewal?
They're both renewal levies, so that's on top of what they're currently paying today for the levies.
Do you know what they're paying today? What were $400,000 house is paying today for the levies?
The total amount on a $400,000 house this year, and this is both of these levies plus a third levy that's not on the ballot this time.
What's the third one?
It's a minor capital levy that's called BTA, Building Technology and Academics. They're currently paying around $999 annually on that. So this is an increase of about $152 over that.
So $1,049 or something.
Yeah, right.
So for a $400,000 house. What's the need for Prop 1 and Prop 2? Start with Prop 1. What's the need?
Sure. Prop 1 is the operations levy. And this is really, as you said, a day-to-day basics of what we think of for our kids in terms of what they're getting for education. It's right now, it's about 26% of the district's operating budget. And this is teachers, textbooks, a sixth period in high school, activities such as athletics and arts, things that the state is not fully funding that we make up through our local levy.
Why isn't the state fully funding that?
Well, that was the subject of a lawsuit that recently the Supreme Court decided, and the Supreme Court said that indeed the state was not fully funding basic education in Washington. The solution for that, though, and how they'll get there is still unknown, and the legislature is taking that up. But until the state fully funds that, we can't afford to leave our kids with a gap of a quarter of the daily operating budget.
By the way, that BTA levy, is that also expiring but not being renewed?
We're in the middle of that. It's a six-year levy, so it's not up for renewal until 2016.
I see. And Proposition 2?
Proposition 2 is the large capital levy. It's called BEX, for short for Building Excellence. And this is the levy that does two things here. The first thing is it takes care of, maintains, and renovates our existing schools. More than half of Seattle Public Schools are over 50 years old. And anybody who owns an old home knows you just need to do maintenance. You need to rebuild it sometimes. So we need to make sure we have safe and healthy learning environments for our kids. Earthquake safety upgrades, new roofs on buildings. Things like that. The second thing that Prop 2 is addressing is the incredible growth in Seattle Public Schools. We have kind of a unique story in America right now, which is our urban district is growing, and it's growing quickly. This year alone, we added about 1,400 new students on top of the enrollment from last year. That's the equivalent of about three elementary schools worth of kids. So we actually need to renovate old buildings to expand capacity. We need to actually build new buildings or take buildings that are not currently in use and bring them back to life, because we need seats for our kids. We have some schools that are over capacity, and we need to be able to give all those kids a good learning environment.
When did Seattle Public Schools close schools?
I'm not sure of the exact date of it. It was within the past decade.
It was earlier than that.
Yeah.
They missed their projections on growth. Why should we continue to pass levies when the school district itself can't quite get their growth projections right?
Well, I don't know what went into the growth projections when they were closing schools. And what I do know is the process that they used to project an enrollment for the next decade, where they're projecting about 7,000 additional kids. And they went through a very detailed process with the community. There's a committee that was formed after the school closures to talk about capacity issues with the district, of parents and community members, experts in the field. The district had its own demographer. It also worked with the City of Seattle demographer. And so they went through a very rigorous process to try to determine what will the growth be. They're already seeing overcapacity issues in some areas, particularly in North Seattle and in West Seattle. So they know the enrollment is on the rise. And they went through a process that was well vetted, that I think that the community can trust is one that is as accurate as you can get with demography.
Chris Jackins, what do you think of that? What do you think of that answer? That's part of the critique of this levy by you and some others, that the district hasn't done a good job projecting its growth.
That's true. They have not done a good job. We, in fact, brought the district to court to try and stop school closures. They said, "Oh no, they're absolutely needed," and it was absolutely wrong. And they've sold off those schools for peanuts. Some of them were worth $10 million, and they sold them for $3 million.
Which one?
That was the one up on Finney Ridge, about 65th and Finney. And they sold it to the group that was leasing it, and they were the only group, the member of the public, that got to know what the actual assessed value was.
You don't have much argument against the Proposition 1?
We are only concentrating on the capital levy, Proposition 2.
Do you have an argument against Proposition 1, or do you support it?
We signed up with the Public Disclosure Commission, and when you do that, you're supposed to say which issues you're going to talk about. We said Proposition 2, so we're simply just not talking about Proposition 1. It seems to be what the rules require us to do.
So you have no opinions.
Thank you for your smile. And I certainly have background to know about interesting things about the levees generally. But
like what? Since you're being so unclear about this, what general ideas do you have about the levee?
Well, we are trying to focus on the capital levee. And the capital levee has some very large problems in terms of mega schools. That the district is proposing six mega schools, 650 students each, Arbor Heights, Genesee Hill, Olympic Hills, Thornton Creek, Wilson Pacific, and Wing Luke. Mega schools are going to kill off neighborhood schools. That's part of this plan. And that isn't generally realized. That isn't what the district is talking about. That's what's going on. Arbor Heights is nearby Rocks Hill, and the original proposal was to close Rocks Hill and merge it into Arbor Heights.
What's wrong with that proposal to make bigger schools?
It's wrong because it does not recognize the community's connections to its schools. These are neighborhood schools. The district is saying, oh, neighborhood schools, that's the wonderful thing we're pushing with our new assignment plan. In fact, if you're going to close a bunch of schools, which is still the plan, that's the plan with mega schools, it's completely opposite of what the district is talking about with the public. It's disingenuous. And it's not good educationally. People, whenever I talk to people, they say, mega schools? No, I don't want my kids in a mega school. And mega schools are also being used to zap community after community after community. A prime example is the Native American community at Wilson Pacific. Wilson Pacific, those programs have been there for decades, and that site is directly next to Licton Springs. That area has been associated with the Native American community for hundreds of years. The district is going to bulldoze that entire site. People who have seen our yard signs have seen a picture of Chief Joseph. That is a photo of a mural that's two stories tall on the side of one of the buildings at Wilson Pacific.
So is that your main criticism of this, that they're going to destroy this mural and destroy this program, if the program is destroyed?
They're going to evict the programs and destroy those murals. And other schools, it's the same disconnect with communities. Thornton Creek, they have a wonderful school already there. They have a nice playfield, and they're going to plop down a mega school onto the playfield, ruin the playfield, and you're going to have 1,000 elementary kids, one batch of them in an alternative school program, one in a regular school program, all mashing together. There's a number of other schools that are similarly affected. Schmitz Park will be moved over to Genesee Hill to a mega school there. Schmitz Park, the land was given by the Schmitz family for a neighborhood school years ago. They gave it for $1. And when the school district came up with this plan, they didn't even tell the family about it. A member of the family goes to the school at the beginning of the opening of school every year, and they didn't even bother to tell them. I told them.
But isn't this the planning that the school district has to do in order to accommodate growth?
Growth can be accommodated in other ways. You want to spread it around to keep your neighborhood schools strong. You don't want mega schools zapping the existing schools. Neighborhood connections are very important. That history is very important. And the district has had a problem with that for a number of years. That's why they've sold off schools. That's why they've disconnected with, gee, is it important to have your program here, your program there? Right now, last week, they delayed a vote because they couldn't figure out their demographics.
All right, let's walk backwards through some of those. But let's start with the school that's at Wilson Pacific. What's going to happen to that Native American program, Greg Wong?
Sure. So there's a few issues that Mr. Jackins brought up. We'll start with Wilson Pacific. That site is one where the building is old, and the district there's a great need both for a new elementary school and for a new middle school. Many people who have middle schoolers in North Seattle know that the middle schools are just incredibly overcrowded. And in the district's commitment to keeping neighborhood schools where families know that they have a seat in the school by them, they'll be building new schools on that site. There is currently a program, a Native American program there, and as with any rebuilding project, the program will be relocated.
It's not, where, do you know?
I don't know that yet. I believe that's a separate decision that the district makes. There's a different process they go through.
But they're saying they will relocate that program?
That's what I've
heard. It will not be disbanded?
Right. The district does is they take a look at the buildings and say, what is our building needs? And then they make a plan for building needs, and then separately they take a look at programs and academics and say, what are the program needs? So then they will then find a place for the programs, just as with any of these schools that are being rebuilt, a school community that's moving.
You know, you're sort of you're speaking for the district. You don't actually, you don't really know if that Native American program is going to be somewhere else.
Well, I've asked the district about it. I don't work for the district. We're a separate campaign organization. But certainly it's an issue that Mr. Jackins has raised and the community is concerned about. So I have asked the district about it.
What's going to happen with the mural? Is that going to be knocked down?
So the mural, the district, in fact, even through this weekend, has been meeting with the artist. And there's a plan, and they're working on a memorandum of understanding. I don't know where that is in the process. But the plan is that they would digitize the mural, and then it would be recreated on the new buildings. And they're working with the artist on that.
Are they going to move the Native American program to Northgate Mall? Have you heard that?
I have not heard that. And Northgate Mall is... not a district property, so I'm not sure exactly where that would come from.
Well, they might establish a school there. What about the argument that these big schools are not neighborhood schools?
Sure. Well, I think it actually kind of is an argument that's upside down, because the entire need to have some larger schools is because there is tremendous growth in enrollment in certain neighborhoods. And so the district committed in its assignment plan that if you lived in a certain neighborhood, you'd be assigned to your neighborhood school. And so in order to accommodate that, some neighborhoods do need larger schools. I think one thing to point out is that the district is actually pre-planning some here. Saying it's a building that could accommodate 650 students does not mean that once that building opens, it will have 650 students in it. But it would have the capacity to be expanded up to that if that was the need.
Do you think a big school is a good idea?
Well, I mean, I think that there's different sides of that debate. I think that one thing that happens, though, in larger schools that is sometimes counterintuitive for parents is class sizes are often smaller in larger schools than in smaller schools. When you have a larger school, you can actually concentrate more resources there. You're not duplicating administrative staff, counselors, lunchroom staff, custodians. And so you can actually focus more resources in a larger school.
Efficiencies, Chris Jackins. That's what you want. You want a smarter school district. They're giving you efficiencies.
No. The efficiencies don't work. You don't want to throw away good education for efficiency. The school district has been going along on rote private money ideas. These are not representative of public school ideas. This is a continuation of
going along on rote private money ideas. What do you mean by that?
That the big foundations.
Oh, you're saying this is a Gates Foundation generated idea.
Thank you.
That's what you're saying, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. This is a model about 7-Elevens saying, oh, you know, we'll shove our 7-Elevens together where, you know, the most people are. You know, that we'll do the most efficiencies and we'll cut costs. Have they cut costs? I haven't seen it. I've watched these budgets for years, and the school closures, in fact, cost money. It costs a lot of money to move around. It's very disruptive to education. The original proposal on Arbor Heights was to build a mega school there. Arbor Heights needs work, but the original proposal included moving Rocks Hill, closing Rocks Hill and moving it to Arbor Heights. Neither of the communities wanted that. They knew it wasn't good for education. The school district quit talking about it, but they haven't changed the capital proposal. They're still spending the money there. They're still putting these giant mega schools into the neighborhoods that don't want them.
I guess we'll find out if the neighborhoods don't want them, right? Because we'll see by the vote. But when you look at the idea of putting Thornton Creek as a second school in that Thornton Creek field, is that a good use of that land?
Well, I mean, one of the realities for the South Public School District is that they have limited options when it comes to building new schools. They have to work with the land or the property that they own. There's not a lot of spaces large enough inside the city limits where the district could go buy a huge parcel of land and build a school. And so when they look at where the needs are for capacity and they see a need for seats in the Northeast and they have an open plot of land, I think that it would actually be fiscally irresponsible if they ignored that and went off and spent money on purchasing land in order to build a new school.
Of course, you know, we're back to that question of closing schools again. It costs them money to close schools, and they they made some errors or mistakes or jumped the gun. I don't know how you want to assess that, but they closed schools, and maybe the schools weren't in the right place. Is that one of the reasons they closed them? Do you remember?
Well,
that was one of the arguments they made.
Well, I think that it's interesting because with the shift with the assignment plan, where they are guaranteeing seats in the neighborhood schools, it does change how you look at capacity and where the buildings need to be sited. The district is, if you look at the capital levy, the new seats are concentrated in those areas of the city where there is the need for new seats, North Seattle and West Seattle.
What do you think of the idea of using levies to pay for schools? And this is the overarching question of the McCleary decision and how we fund things. What do you think of it, that you're doing this as a volunteer? This is the work you're doing to raise money for the schools. But what do you think that you have to go out and ask voters to raise their property taxes up and above the money they pay to fund schools, or not enough money they pay to fund schools?
Well, you know, in the ideal world, this would all be fully funded by the state and we wouldn't have to run levies. And I'm sure that myself and all the countless of other volunteers who pour hundreds of hours into the campaign probably would be okay with that if that was a volunteer opportunity taken away from us, because then the state would be fulfilling its basic obligations. But the reality is, until that happens, we have to give our kids the schools and the education that they deserve. We can't wait on the state for that, because it's if we don't run the levy campaign and if we don't pass the levies, it's only our kids that'll suffer.
You know, the Municipal League, in supporting this proposition, Chris Jackins, they said the next phase of the levy passes will be supplemental environmental review for individual projects. In those project level reviews, the city will help ensure the needed infrastructure is in place. May require the district provide additional street and site improvements. I guess I also take from that they are going to look somewhat at the complaint you're making, whether they're in the right place. Does that answer your concerns?
No. I have been through those environmental reviews at neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood. They don't work. They're skewed very much towards the school district. Whatever the school district wants, the school district gets to appoint a number of people to the committees that review exemptions from the zoning codes. Roosevelt, the committee that was appointed was full of neighborhood people with architectural background, construction background. They said, look, you know, it's going to be a mess with parking. We can put a parking lot. There's available money. Put a parking lot underneath the field. School district wouldn't go for it, and the city rejected that. The same sort of problems come at school after school after school site. The time to deal with these problems is now, to say, look, get your ducks in a row. You don't actually know where the students are going yet. You delayed a vote from last week on the transition plan for the new student assignment plan to a special meeting you set up just this Thursday because you don't know what the numbers are yet.
If this fails and we have this problem with funding schools that we have in the state, what do you say to those people who said, oh, now we have to wait another chunk of time before we get money to build these schools that we need?
And I'm only talking about the capital levy, but with the capital levy, the law allows school district to fix the proposal and bring it back within just a couple months. That's what I would recommend to the district. They haven't done it right. They need that opportunity. The voters are in this loop. They have a chance to say, look, we don't want these things. If we give them the money, the situation is always the district has the money. The voters have spoken. No, we don't need to pay attention to the neighborhoods anymore. I've been through this.
Well, you can respond to the neighborhood thing too. But last question, if this passes, we again will see voters in this area ponying up more money for schools, but overall Washington State still suffers from a lack of funding for its K-12 at least. Don't we just keep sort of feeding the beast by passing these levies?
It's a hard position to be in. I mean, if we don't feed the beast, then once again, our kids suffer. And so I think that there is a process, the legislative process. We have, you know, you can talk to your legislators, you can let them know that this is the number one priority, that they need to create a sustainable plan that schools can rely on and is sufficient. There's a process we can use as voters to influence the state's actions that's separate from this levy. We need to pass the levy to make sure that the kids get the education they need, but then we also need to take the other step and work on the state level. Now, on the community piece, I do want to point out that if you talk to the communities of these schools that are overcrowded, that would be getting new buildings, talk to Arbor Heights, you talk to the Schmitz Park community, the parents there are thrilled. You should talk to those communities because they want their kids in safe and healthy learning environments. They want their kids in a school that isn't entirely overcrowded. And the district is making a plan to address needs that are anticipated in the coming years. And that plan is a good one. And we feel good that it is solid and all the projects are needed. The last BEX levy that's being renewed, every project came in on time and within budget. I think that's a powerful statement to voters.
That's Greg Wong. He's president of Schools First, campaign to help pass Seattle school levies. And Chris Jackins, coordinator for Seattle Committee to Save Schools, official spokesperson for No on Prop 2. On February 12th, Seattle voters will be asked whether or not to renew two expiring levies to fund Seattle public schools, Prop 1 and Prop 2. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Learn more about local and state education issues at KUOW.org. Just click on Education. And next up here on the radio, Dennis the Bomb Sniffing Dog is our guest. That's just 7 dog minutes away. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
The attacks on 9/11, the crime of the century, and yet no convictions down at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility.
Just became a political football. It's very, very sad. You know, my son's dead almost 12 years now, and we've had nothing.
9/11 families get a chance to watch the slow wheels of justice at Gitmo. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society and Philharmonia Northwest, presenting Songs of Heaven, featuring chorale preludes by Bach and Respighi, Dvorak's Te Deum, and Chichester Psalms by Bernstein, Saturday, February 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at Meany Hall. Tickets at kirklandchoralsociety.org or Brown Paper Tickets.
41 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Expect it to be breezy and rainy today with a high of 43. It's 9:41. Later this hour, the sounds of a tugboat working on a river in Paris. That's somewhere within the next 20 minutes or so.
Now, back to the world of police and their tools, some living tools. Dennis, a yellow lab, he has a favorite chew toy, he loves food, he chases squirrels when he's given the chance. But Dennis also has a very important job. He's a bomb dog for the Seattle Police Department. Katie Sewell, you met Dennis and Officer Craig Williamson, his handler, huh?
I did, and Dennis was extremely excited when I arrived, excited to have a visitor in his house, and he even brought me his favorite chew toy.
Sure.
So, hi.
Dennis.
No, it's okay. We like hearing him, so.
We'll take the sweet toy away, yeah. But, I mean, that's his favorite toy when he's around.
Hey, Dennis.
Why don't you introduce to me who you are, like what your name is and what you do, and maybe introduce us to this fellow here as well.
My name is Craig Williamson. I work for the Seattle Police Department, and for the last 10 years, I've been a bomb dog handler. For the last 3 years, I've had Dennis, my partner, Yellow Lab. He's 5.5 years old. Prior to Dennis, I had a dog named Freddie, who's basically a clone to Dennis, Yellow Lab. And when he passed away in 2009, we got Dennis.
Where does he come from?
He was raised as a guide dog and didn't pass guide dog school for this propensity to be curious and wanting to see what's underneath the tables, underneath the couch. So they cross-trained him to be a bomb dog, and the ATF picked him up, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. I went for training, and it was an 11-week course, and that's where I met Dennis. So about 16 weeks gets you a baseline dog. And then it's an everyday occurrence with training with him. He's a food reward dog, whereas some dogs work for a toy. This dog works for food. He doesn't get a bowl of food at the end of the day like most dogs. He gets increments of food for finding an explosive odor. So throughout the day, days off, sick days, vacation days, you have to take time out of your day, put things out for the dog to find in order for the dog to get fed.
So you can't go on vacation then?
You can go on vacation, but the dog comes with, and at some point you excuse yourself and you hide something. Yeah, it's like a big game of hide-and-go-seek. Actually, a lot of people like to get involved with it. I can give people some things for the dog to find, my nieces or friends, neighbors. They like to put stuff out and challenge the dog.
What were you doing before 10 years ago when you started working with dogs?
I started the police department in 1985, and I worked in patrol for 7 years. In 1994, I got a tracking dog. Those are the dogs, a stereotypical German Shepherd, trained to find people that have left the scene of a crime. I worked Jake from 1994 to 2002. Then we got our first bomb dog, the first bomb dog on the department. That was Freddie, and that was in 2003. He died unexpectedly in 2009, and he was replaced with Dennis.
How did he die?
He died, it was unexpected. It was a pancreatitis problem. It couldn't be stopped, and he couldn't be saved. And unfortunately, he passed away.
Yeah, it must have been hard. He was your partner, right?
He is. He's very, very close when you're working with a dog, and he stays with me, 24 hours a day, every day. It was very hard. Mm-hmm. The Seattle Police Foundation stepped in. They helped the department to get this dog.
How is it going with Dennis? You've been together for 3 years now?
Very good. He's a very good bomb dog. We get called to everything from crime scene searches to if a dignitary is coming to town, the Secret Service will call us. Typically, we would search their motorcade vehicles, where they're going to be staying, maybe where they're going to be speaking. Homicide and CSI unit uses us a lot when there has been a shooting, if they're looking for a gun that may have been discarded by a suspect running away from the scene. And if someone says that maybe there were 6 shots fired, but they've only been able to recover 4, then we bring Dennis in, and he's capable of finding the shell casings. We do a lot of bomb sweeps at Safeco Field for the Mariner games, CenturyLink Field for the Seahawk games. We go to about 200 calls a year.
How often does he actually get to find something out in the field?
Finding something is low because there's just not a lot to find. It's not that he's not capable of finding it. It's just not there. If we get called to a crime scene and, he doesn't find something, it generally means that it's not there. The gun wasn't there. There's no more shell casings to find. So the success of actually finding something is actually pretty low.
Are bomb dogs normal for a police department to have?
Yes. Post 9/11, they're becoming increasingly more popular. King County has 3 bomb dogs. Boeing has 8 bomb dogs. Port of Seattle has 10 bomb dogs. There's a lot of bomb dogs in the area. The State Patrol has 35 bomb dogs.
What are some of the things that you're hiding for him?
We would use what we call low explosives. It could be fireworks, smokeless powder, Pyrodex, which is a synthetic black powder. We've got a discrimination training exercise downstairs, and there's a series of a dozen cans down there. Some cans have food in it. He can't see what's in it. Yeah, there's sniffer tins. It looks like a skull can, shall we say. Mm-hmm. The dog will have to discriminate between anything that can be in a distractor can and the cans that he has to sit on. His alert to tell me there's explosive odor is to sit, and he looks back to me to get fed. My job is to expose him to everything I can so that if we are needed, I'm supplying the best dog for the department.
Now, are there any days when you let him slack off a little bit, make it really easy, like it's just sitting in the middle of your kitchen floor? And
I try not to. No, it's very tempting to do. There's no second chances. With the tracking dog, when I had the tracking dog, if we missed a burglar, if we missed a car prowler, well, that's a car prowler and a burglar that may strike again. If we get it wrong with the bomb dog, someone could get hurt. It's a lot of responsibility, and it's something I don't take lightly.
Okay, well, why don't we do the exercise? I hear, do you want to set it up?
Downstairs in a part of my house, there's a small circle, has a dozen cans. They look like paint cans. And inside the paint can, there's a cork can. Inside the cork can, there's a little sniffer tin. Sniffer tin is either what holds explosive odor or holds a distractor odor. If he wants to get fed, he'll sit on the explosive odor.
I will just follow you, and you can lead the way.
All right. I'll put Dennis on the leash here. All this is a big game for the dog. So you see in here, there's cans. I'll make a presentation on the can, and he'll go around. There's a fourth can is where he's going to sit. I know that because that's where I set it. He doesn't. So I give him an instruction to seek. He puts his nose in the can. He puts his nose in the second can, the third can. And when he gets to the fourth can, he's going to sit down, and he just stays there. I reach my pocket where I keep his daily ration of food. He gets some food, and we move on to the next can. Once a year, we have to certify to a federal level, and they set up an exercise like this, except where there's a dozen cans in here, they'll have 60 cans. And the dog has to get 100%. There is no 99%. 99% makes you fail. Yeah. So, again, there's a lot of pressure to make sure it's done right.
So now he's sat 3 times.
He's sat 3 times. He's gotten 3 kibbles of food. During the course of the day, about 40 of those gets him fed. And it's not like he's starved. He's arguably the most spoiled dog in the department.
And he's so quiet. And I guess if you're a bomb dog, you don't want to be kicking at something.
No, he's very passive. If he gets that wrong and hits it with his paw, then that's a bad day. Then all of a sudden I'm being named for a school. And they probably named the school after Dennis, not even me. Dennis is very popular on the department. You couldn't ask for a better partner.
I like that he's still doing the search to get more
he's
food while we're talking.
Yeah, as we talk here, yeah, if we're sitting here and talking, again, he wants to get fed. That's a good thing about a dog. His desire right now is to find explosive odor. That's all he wants to do. All he wants to do is get fed. The human traits that can be bad, you know, he doesn't have. He's got unconditional love and a desire to work for food. What more do you want? I'm going to take him out of this room.
Okay.
Only because if we keep standing there, he's going to work on it, finding as much explosive odor as he can. Every day is spent doing a little bit something different. I work with the regional bomb dogs in this area. We'll get together and train in different venues. We'll go to auto auctions and use the cars in the lot. We'll go to theaters and warehouses, cars, trains, planes, so that if we do get a call of a bomb threat, I know that my dog wouldn't be apprehensive to get on a moving train.
Why give him a food reward rather than a toy?
What we were talking about earlier, where it's appealing to do to slack off. Maybe you're tired. I don't get a break. It sounds kind of odd, but he has to be fed. I have to set something out. It produces an exceptional dog in that regards. He's always being exposed to explosive odor at least about 40 times a day.
So you have like the safest house on the block.
It probably is. If they're delivering mail, it's probably the safest mail that's I get to open. Yes. Yeah.
It's a massive commitment for you.
It is. It is. But it's fun. And the payoff is great. If they see us out working, they may see us at Safeco Field. It's a little yellow lab, about 57 pounds. By all means, approach me and say you'd like to meet the dog. More than happy to show the dog to anyone that wants to see him. So I know what he's done for me, and I'd like to bring Dennis to other people. He does. He produces a lot of smiles.
That's Officer Craig Williamson, a bomb handler for the Seattle Police Force, talking with Katie Sewell for our On the Job series. He's in charge of a yellow lab named Dennis, one of two dogs in the department. Hey, if you got some good on the jobs, send us an email, weekday at kuow.org. All right, it's day 15 of the state legislative session. I know you're all counting the days. It's a 105-day session. The Majority Coalition Caucus of 23 Republicans, 2 Democrats, officially took power in the state Senate last week. And this week, they'll get down to business with hearings on family leave, the state's Get Prepaid Tuition program, and fixing up old cars in your garage. Chris Kriegel is Washington State news editor for the Associated Press. Chris, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
So, okay, today the State Senate Commerce and Labor Committee is going to take up a measure that would repeal the never funded yet and never implemented yet mandatory paid family leave for Washington workers. What's happening to this bill?
Well, you know, I think that it's largely a symbolic act that the new majority coalition is aiming for. I think they want to signal that they are more business friendly than the previous majority caucus. The critics say that this is disappointing, that this is one of the first acts that the new majority coalition is trying to push through. It's very unlikely that this would be passed in the House, so this is probably more symbolism than anything else, but this is one of the first battles that they're picking.
I guess they're throwing down their markers.
Correct.
Now, on Thursday, they're going to have a hearing on the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, and Senator Tom, the majority leader, he said he favors an end to the GET program. What are we going to hear at this hearing?
You know, I think what you're going to hear that from Senator Tom and other people's perspectives is that it's just the state can't afford it. That tuition is increasing at such a rate that the state will be facing too much liability with the GET program. The critics point out that it would actually cost the state about $1 billion in a future deficit situation if they were to kill the GET program, and that the most financially prudent thing to do is just to keep it in place. Critics also say that that abandoning the GAP program would pretty much signal that the state is doing nothing to keep the cost of college education affordable for middle-class folks, because if you're rich, you can afford it, and if for people of lesser means, there are programs and scholarships in place that the middle class just don't have access to.
Well, part of the tangle with this program seems to be that the Republicans and, I guess, higher ed supporters and some aspects of higher ed supporters would like to see the colleges have the ability to charge more tuition for more popular programs.
Yes.
and GET sort of, because of the way GET is configured, it keeps that from happening. Is there a chance that there is a way to work out a compromise without killing the program?
You know, I think that's one of the big questions of this session is what happens with GET. The Governor Inslee has really not signaled what he would like to do for the GET program. He hasn't really voiced full-throated support of it, but he hasn't said he would support killing it either. I think that what happens to the GET program and how the state comes up with funding for K-12, to my mind, those are two of the really big questions going forward. The GET program is quite popular, and I think it has allies in the House, but we'll see what happens, and this week will be very informative along those lines.
Chris Kriegel is Washington State News editor for the AP. All right, well, so speaking of that, some people are calling Friday the most honest day of the week because Reuven Carlisle is going to convene the House Finance Committee that he chairs, and the Joint Task Force on Education Funding is going to talk about how they would pay for education in this state. This is a task force that was set up by the governor and legislature to figure out how to pay for education following that McCleary decision that requires more money for public education.
Yeah, and you know, no one's really going to tip their hand for a few weeks until we start seeing specific budget proposals. Governor Inslee is going to have his first budget proposal in March, but some of the ideas floating out there right now are, and Governor Inslee has spoken in support of extending taxes, business and occupation taxes, and taxes on beer that would raise a couple $100 million a year. Ed Murray, the Senate leader of the Democrats, who are now in the minority, favors a capital gains tax. Anything to do with taxes is going to be pretty hard to get through, mostly because of the two-thirds requirement that the legislature has for taxes. So, you know, there's some ideas out there, but there's really no one that people can point to and say, yeah, that'll probably work. But basically, nobody has any idea what's going to happen.
Does the extension of a tax also require a two-thirds vote?
I believe it does.
So basically, the Republicans in the Senate are now going to put up or shut up on how they're going to fund education without raising taxes. They'll have to come up with a plan.
Absolutely. And frankly, Governor Inslee will have to as well, because even assuming that you keep the taxes extended, you're going to need more money. So if you're not going to have a broad tax increase, you have to cut a lot. And the question is, where do you cut? Do you cut in human services? Do you cut in public safety? And it'll be very interesting to see where the various caucuses come down on that.
So, Chris, why is the ability to restore classic cars in jeopardy in Washington State?
Well, I think that's just a question that one of those weird legislative situations where you know, interpretation of the laws are different from everybody's perspective. So, you know, that one's you got to keep an eye on.
They're going to prevent the bill 5121 prevents cities and towns from passing ordinances that prevent people from restoring hobby vehicles or those 30 years or older on their property. So there must have been some complaints, and now they're trying to figure out a way to sort of standardize it, huh?
Those deals were in the off session. Legislators hear from constituents about all sorts of things, and that somebody probably I think it's Jim Honeyford has. I believe he's the one that has dropped this. I could be wrong, but you know, they hear from their constituents, and they want certain things taken care of, and this is one of the things that came across the transom.
That's what state legislatures do. All right, there's a lot of stuff happening this week. We will track it. So is Chris Kriegel, who is the Washington State News editor for the AP. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
This is Weekday.
And now, The sound of the day.
That's the sound of a tugboat pushing a huge barge load of containers up the river in Paris. The containers are going to the supermarket chain Franprix. That's a big old boat. Weekday listener Noel recorded that sound. He's been living in Paris for quite some time now, sending us many sounds from there. Thank you, Noel. What are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of the sound of your day. Send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Stay with us.
It's 10 a.m., a particularly violent weekend in Chicago. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.